Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palka reporting. A historic world climate agreement.
The amendment and decisions are adopted.
That is Rwanda's Minister for Natural Resources, Vincent Biruta, declaring the adoption of a historic agreement to reduce greenhouse gases used in refrigerators and air conditioners, a major step in the fight against climate change. The agreement was announced today at a meeting in Kigali, Rwanda. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Kigali before leaving for Switzerland.
It's a monumental step forward that addresses the needs of individual nations, but it will give us the opportunity to reduce the warming of the planet by an entire half a degree centigrade.
This is United States Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy.
And if you look at it, we are going to achieve somewhere in the order of 80 to 90% of the emission reductions from these chemicals. It is staggering what this will achieve. We're talking about an amount that's comparable to thousands of coal-fired power plant emissions.
The U.S. and most of Europe have committed to reducing their use of the gases incrementally, starting with a 10% cut by 2019. Gunmen kidnapped an American aid worker in Niger on Friday after storming his home and killing two of the worker's guards. The abduction took place in Abalak. The assailants apparently came on a motorbike, killed the guards, and then an SUV came along and drove toward the Mali border. Mali's long porous border has been vulnerable to armed violence in recent years. There's been no claim of responsibility for the abduction. No U.S. citizen had been kidnapped before in Niger, where such a seizure of foreigners is considered to be rare. This is VOA News. Investigators with the Saudi-led coalition fighting Yemeni rebels said Saturday that incorrect information led to the bombing of a crowded funeral in the Yemeni capital last weekend, killing about 140 people and wounding at least 525 others. The Joint Incidents Assessment Team, JIAT, said a party affiliated to the Yemeni presidency of the General Chief of Staff provided the wrong information. JIAT said one of the coalition's warplanes bombed the wrong target, resulting in one of the most deadly strikes in the coalition's nearly 19-month-old bombing campaign in support of the Yemeni government's beleaguered government. The strike prompted strong international criticism, even from Saudi Arabia's closest Western allies. Talks began in the Swiss city of Lausanne on Saturday in another attempt to find a diplomatic solution to the Syrian conflict. Talks are being held among U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and U.N. Special Envoy for Syria Staffan de Mistura. Other foreign ministers from around the region are also involved. Prominent international charities called Saturday for a 72-hour ceasefire in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo's eastern neighborhood. Hundreds of thousands of civilians are trapped in Aleppo, which has seemingly become ground zero in Syria's five-year war. The U.S. and its Western allies accuse Russia and Syria of war crimes for bombing hospitals and U.N. relief convoys in and around Aleppo. And German intelligence says a Syrian refugee arrested in Germany this week was plotting to bomb a Berlin airport in the name of Islamic State. Jaber al-Bakr, a 22-year-old who'd been granted asylum, was detained with the help of Syrian migrants. In an RTL interview, one of the three Syrian men who stopped the suspect said he and his friends felt duty-bound to detain al-Bakr and called the police. Now, the man, whose voice was disguised and was given the assumed name of Mohammed A to protect his identity, said he was angry to find out someone would plan such an act given that Germany had opened doors for Syrian refugees. Three people have been arrested in the United States of Kansas for allegedly planning an attack on a mosque and a housing complex. So apparently not only in Germany are Somali communities at any kind of risk. Reports said that suspects are member of a right-wing militia here in the United States. If the three defendants are convicted, they face a maximum sentence of life in prison. The attack is believed to have targeted a Somali immigrant community. The area of Kansas has a meatpacking plant that employs a diverse immigrant population. For more on all these stories, visit our website at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Political candidates submitted their forms, out of which 12 of the candidates' forms could not be accepted for various reasons of infractions, irregularities, inadequacies on the forms.
The Electoral Commission of Ghana disqualifies 12 presidential candidates ahead of the December polls.
Everyone is just waiting for the president to touch down and possibly explain to Malawians where he was, and more importantly, why the State House didn't find it appropriate to tell Malawians where the president was.
The Malawian government announces President Arthur Mutharika will return to the country Sunday.
I think it was in some ways inevitable because the African Union has been very critical of the ICC, has in fact called on countries to withdraw.
And the Burundian parliament votes to leave the International Criminal Court, or ICC. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Electoral Commission of Ghana has sharply rejected accusations that its decision to disqualify a presidential candidate from participating in the December 7 general election were politically motivated. The Electoral Commission disqualified 12 presidential candidates for failing to meet requirements ahead of the September 30 deadline to file their nomination document. Eric Jakpasu, spokesman for the Electoral Commission, explained why the candidates were disqualified.
The commission realized that a number of candidates had not fulfilled the essential legal requirements for qualification to become candidates. In fact, 17 political candidates submitted their forms, out of which 12 of the candidates' forms could not be accepted for various reasons of infractions, irregularities, inadequacies, misrepresentations on the forms. So upon critical scrutiny, 12 of the nomination forms, that is of candidates, were not accepted by the commission. So at the end of the nomination process, we say that four candidates of the New Patriotic Party, led by Nana Akufo-Addo, the NDC candidates, that is His Excellency President John Dramani Mahama, the Convention People's Party, led by Avo Greenstreet, and one independent candidate, Jacob Osei Yeboah, they stand duly nominated to contest in the presidential election.
You talked about misrepresentation and all that. There are legal ramifications for that. Does that mean that some people committed acts of illegality which could be punishable by the Ghanaian laws? And what is the EC doing about this?
The chairperson of the Electoral Commission had a press briefing and she indicated clearly that cases of forgery, cases of impersonation, suspected cases of misrepresentation will be reported to the police and then to the Attorney General for investigation and possible prosecution.
The PPP, one of the parties that was disqualified at the presidential level, said that some of these disqualifications, including the NDP, the former First Lady's party, said that these disqualifications were politically motivated and that this was purposely meant to basically give one party or the other advantage in the presidential election. What is your reaction to that?
That is very far from the truth. All these forms were scrutinized in line with the provisions of the law relating to the nomination of candidates. And inadequacies, omissions, and as I indicated earlier, irregularities were found on these forms. For instance, the presidential candidates, for example, are supposed to have two registered voters per each administrative district subscribing to their candidature. And a subscriber cannot subscribe to more than one candidate. But here were cases where we had one subscriber subscribing to more than two, three, four of the candidates, and on each form, four different kinds of signatures. Okay, so the forms are there. The evidence is there for all of them to see. The commission has written to them, stating the grounds for the rejection of their nominations. So the accusations that these are politically motivated, designed to favor one or the other political party, is not true. the grounds for the rejection has been submitted to them. The law is there, and they can relate their forms to the law and then establish whether indeed they complied with the provisions of the law or not.
The PPP also said that the stubbornness of the Electoral Commission could plunge the entire country into chaos and possible instability. What say you?
The Electoral Commission is focused and it's applying the rules and regulations of the elections to its latter. Here is the case. When you submit your nomination form, you have a time period for the corrections or omissions, if any. These parties came for these forms. The Commission launched a document on a guide to candidates directing them how to fill this form. The Electoral Commission is just sticking to the rules and applying the law to the letter. Now, when you ask some of these candidates who have been disqualified, they tell you that what was detected in their form, they classify them as minor administrative errors. Meanwhile, the law has not created that room for discretion where what they are describing as minor administrative errors could be accepted as basis for filing the nomination. So the Electoral Commission is not being stubborn. The Electoral Commission is only being firm and applying the rules fairly across the board.
Now that the process basically is moving forward, what's next for the Electoral Commission in this process ahead of the elections?
Yeah, the next most important thing for the Electoral Commission to do right now is to let those who have gone through the nomination process successfully to ballot for their positions on the ballot paper. Okay, the positions taken by the candidates and the presidential candidates will also inform the position of their respective candidates at the parliamentary level. So the next important thing now is to let them ballot for the positions on the ballot paper. Then we can proceed now to print the notices of polls and then the ballot paper and other related documents.
Eric Jakpasu is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Ghana. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. The Malawian government has announced that President Arthur Peter Mutharika will return to the country Sunday, weeks after attending the UN General Assembly. A cross-section of Malawians have demanded information regarding the whereabouts of the president after the meeting. This after expressing concern the administration in Lungwe has refused to inform the public about the whereabouts of the president. Kumbo Soko, the general secretary of the Malawi Law Society, says demand for information about the president's whereabouts is legitimate.
The latest is that we've had information from the State House press office that the president is returning on Sunday. And everyone is just waiting with a bated breath for the president to touch down and possibly explain to Malawians where he was and, more importantly, why the State House didn't find it appropriate to tell Malawians where the president was after his engagements at the UN General Assembly. As you can imagine, it has given rise to quite some very unhealthy speculation. And I think all this was really needless. If people had just been told where the president was, there would have been no need for people to engage in speculation, as it were.
Do you think the calls for information about the whereabouts of the president are legitimate?
Well, absolutely. The way we see it, it's part of accountability. The starting point must be that if you exercise powers of state, you're doing so on behalf of people. The people are the ones that have put you in office, and therefore they have a legitimate interest in knowing where you are. After all, if it's indeed correct that the president was in the U.S. on our behalf and that he was working after the U.N. General Assembly, then it was actually the public that was footing his bill. And in that respect, it was only going to be fair for the people of Malawi to be told where at least the president was. So insofar as we're concerned, I think the concerns are absolutely legitimate.
Why this level of secrecy surrounding the president? Some people are speculating that it could possibly be as a result of what happened during independence time, which has continued till this day. What is your take?
Well, I mean, that's a fair assessment. We seem to be struggling to shake off the legacy of, I think, the 30 years of the one-party rule, when things were very secretive, when matters of relating to the president were only known by a tiny circle of people. The constitutional order that we adopted in 1994, I think it does envisage a more open and transparent government where this kind of thing should really be routine and not, you know, people struggling to get this kind of very simple, you know, information from the public. So it's quite legitimate that I think it's a hangover from our troubled past.
Some Malawians I spoke with said that there should be more transparency, even if the constitution has to be amended to ensure the information is freely given, so it will prevent speculation that could be dangerous even to the security and stability of the state. What say you?
Well, I mean, there is actually no need to amend the constitution insofar as we're concerned. I think it's permissive enough. Its provisions are expansive enough. They make it absolutely clear that those who govern do so on behalf of the people of Malawi. The obligations to be transparent and open and to account to the people of Malawi are clearly spelled out in the constitution. So whatever is happening now is not really as a result of, you know, want of constitutional provisions that speak to them. It's just that we're struggling to live out what the constitution spells out.
Some supporters of the president are saying the opposition is scoring cheap political point as a result of this, and that the president is the president and he will come back Sunday and explain things, and that they are trying to make political capital of nothing. You think their defense is legitimate?
I mean, let me leave politics to politicians, but, you know, like like I've said, I think it's a legitimate legal legal question as to why people aren't being told where the head of state is, and you know, that I think that should have been done. They should have been more transparent in handling that particular bit of information. As to the politics of it all, maybe we're safer leaving that to the politicians.
Kumbo Soko is the General Secretary of the Malawi Law Society. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The Burundian National Parliament has voted to leave the International Criminal Court, or the ICC. What will the move mean, and is it easy to do? For answers to these questions and others, VOA's William Eagle spoke to Mark Ellis, the executive director of the International Bar Association in London.
I think it was in some ways inevitable because the African Union has been very critical of the ICC, has in fact called on countries to withdraw. Under the Rome Statute, it is permissible to withdraw from the court's jurisdiction. So what Burundi is doing is not in any way illegal. It's also not a decision that will protect Burundi from the current investigation that is occurring by the ICC.
Why would it not? And would investigation findings carry any weight in Burundi if it withdraws from the Rome Statute?
Well, generally, because under the Rome Statute, the withdrawal takes effect 1 year after the date of receipt of the notification. And so once the UN Secretary General is notified, then the clock begins to tick, and it will be a year before the withdrawal officially takes place. But until that time, it doesn't in any way discharge the country's obligation under the Rome Statute. It's still, in essence, a party to the statute, and therefore any investigations that are occurring or could occur. The prosecutor could initiate additional proceedings during this year period. And let's remember that the court is only conducting a preliminary investigation. They haven't indicted anyone. The preliminary investigation is at the very start of the process. It's just allowing the prosecutor to look at evidence, collect evidence, do, in essence, a preliminary review to determine whether or not she wants to pursue a full indictment. And that can take a very, very long time, but it would not in any way prevent the court from continuing to pursue a full indictment since it has now initiated a preliminary indictment.
If the ICC, through its preliminary investigation, does come up with an indictment in years in the future, even if Burundi is no longer a signatory to the Rome Statute, it could potentially indict people and jail them or find them innocent, either way, despite the withdrawal of Burundi from the ICC?
The court doesn't have a police force. It doesn't have any enforcement mechanism. It relies on the cooperation of the state and the international community at large. And so far, we've seen that if you fail to get the cooperation of the state, then it's, again, very difficult to pursue any type of investigation. And the international community, including the UN Security Council, generally has been silent and has not stepped up. So I think if the withdrawal happens, even if the ICC pursues a case, then I think it's unlikely that you will, in fact, not only get an indictment, but have a transfer of the indictees to The Hague for a trial.
Does the head of the ICC or the Assembly of State Parties have anything to do with approving or disapproving of the move by states like Burundi who wish to leave?
There could be political pressure on Burundi from the international community, and particularly those states who have signed the Rome Statute and are state parties. I suspect that's where the pressure could come from to say to Burundi, this is a mistake. It sends out the wrong message. You shouldn't do that. But there's no enforcement mechanism either within the court nor, for instance, within the UN Security Council or the UN Assembly. It's a decision that the state makes on its own.
If Burundi does quit the Rome Statute and the ICC, what's left for investigating or punishing or trying any of these actors behind the violence there?
The option that still exists is a concept of universal jurisdiction. And universal jurisdiction says that there are some crimes that are so heinous that all countries have a responsibility to ensure that those who commit those crimes are brought to justice. And so that makes it difficult for individuals who are accused of committing these crimes to travel outside the country because they could be very fearful that they would be arrested under this universal jurisdiction concept.
That was Mark Ellis of the International Bar Association in London. He spoke with viewers William Eagle. With an endowment of nearly $50 billion, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the largest private foundation in the world. It partners with government, the UN, NGOs and grassroots groups to fight poverty and disease. To understand more about the Gates Foundation and its work, viewers Adam Phillips spoke with Mark Suzman, President of Global Policy and Advocacy and Chief Strategy Officer. He began their conversation by explaining the meaning of his long job title.
The first part is essentially the division of the foundation that's about partnerships, about how do we work with governments, with multilateral agencies like the UN or the World Bank, with civil society, to care about and work with the issues we work on in health and development. And as Chief Strategy Officer, I'm also constantly looking at ways we can get smarter and more effective about our own work and how we allocate our own resources to make sure we're getting the biggest bang for our buck in terms of lives saved and people helped.
Okay. In a kind of a conceptual sense, what does a partnership really mean across the board, no matter how big or how small? How do you look at that?
For the kind of issues that we work on and care about at the Gates Foundation, which are working to prevent and hopefully ultimately eradicate HIV/AIDS or TB or malaria, or to work on agricultural development to help smallholder farmers in Africa or Asia, we know we need to bring partners along. They're often governments, they're often private sector players. For example, in HIV, TB, and malaria, we've had a phenomenal weekend hosted by Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada in Montreal. There was a successful replenishment called the Global Fund to Fight HIV, TB, and Malaria, where $12.9 billion was raised for the next 3 years, and that will save at minimum 8 million additional lives. We've contributed $600 million to that as the Gates Foundation, but that's $12.3 billion that have come from other partners.
That's more than they make in a week.
Yeah. And it's a real testament, because this is a tough time to talk about these kinds of issues and to get the generosity of rich countries like the US or the UK or France or Germany, but also, for the first time, this was a number of African countries themselves made direct contributions.
Why is this a tough time?
It's a tough time because, really, since 2008, it's tough to persuade publics in rich countries who historically have given generously that at a time of big trade-offs and constraints, why should you give money to poor people abroad when you have poor people in your own country? And how do we know that money's going to be well spent? we care about other people, but isn't it all wasted? Doesn't it all go into Swiss bank accounts for dictators? And this is our ability to say, no, that's not true. We actually have really concrete examples. This Global Fund is one. We have similar issues in vaccines. We have similar examples in other areas we work where this is actually really well-spent dollars, saving lives, building livelihoods, building self-sufficiency, but it's a constant challenge to make that case.
Again, now stepping back for a moment, what is it that you need to do in order to enlist them in this?
The combination. One of it is actually telling the stories. These are very human stories. Most people, whether it's an ordinary person in the street or whether it's a leading government official, actually want to do the right thing. They care about people, they want to do things, but they need to be persuaded that it's not all hopeless, that there really are concrete interventions that work and can help. And so one is painting that picture. Here's how this contribution actually drives down the cost of antiretroviral drugs or drives down the cost of bed nets. Here's how many lives it can save. Here's how it gets out. Here's how we check to make sure nothing's been stolen or misspent. And then the second element of that is to show that it's value for money. People care. Is there an efficiency? Is this being smartly well spent? And here's the Gates Foundation and working for Bill and Melinda Gates, they are quite vociferous on the subject. This is their money they're putting in. It's got to be well spent. They expect a return. They expect value for money. And so that's one of the lenses we bring in. And so that's a little bit of DNA that I think when we're talking to partners, we're able to bring in and get them excited and willing to contribute.
It sounds like it's a real marriage of sort of altruism and practical self-interest.
Absolutely. You know, we've got to be hard-headed about it. Compassion or empathy are the starting points, but this is not just about caring. It's about getting results in terms of lives impacted in a very meaningful way.
That was Mark Sussman at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He spoke with viewers Adam Phillips in New York. An estimated 250 million children under 5 in low- and middle-income countries are at an elevated risk of poor development due to extreme poverty and stunting, according to findings from The Lancet's new series. The Lancet Early Childhood Development Series was launched at a stakeholder event in Washington, D.C., just ahead of the World Bank Group International Monetary Fund annual meetings. My colleague Douglas Impuga caught up with one of the authors of the report, Professor Gary Darmstadt of Stanford University, and began by asking him about the key findings in the report.
One of the key findings is that the number of children at risk of suboptimal development or of not really developing up to their full potential is enormous. We found that if you look at just two risk factors, one of them being living in poverty, another being stunted in your physical growth, there are 43% of children in low- and middle-income countries around the world who have these two risk factors that place them at serious risk of not really developing up to their full potential. What this translates into is that children who have these two risk factors end up earning about 25% less as adults than those who do not have these risk factors.
Is there anything common among the countries with high prevalence of children living in extreme poverty or stunted?
Well, you know, I'll reverse that and say that there's something common about those countries that are able to overcome some of these factors, because poverty and stunting is really highly prevalent in many places throughout South Asia, throughout Sub-Saharan Africa, even into Latin America. But what we found, we looked at countries across the world, and we found some good examples of countries, despite being poor, are able to provide these kinds of interventions. And what we found is that it's really critically important that the leadership of those countries understand these principles and act upon them, and that they prioritize them in the investments that they make in their people. And on the other hand, it's extremely important that the people are aware and that they're demanding that their governments provide these kinds of opportunities for kinds of intervention.
Talking of leaders being committed, does increased global commitment to early childhood development translate into individual countries taking up the challenge?
Yes, it does. In fact, a great example, just this past week, we launched the Lancet series in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, there was a meeting at the World Bank on investing in the early years. We had I guess, 10 different ministers, most of them from sub-Saharan Africa, who stood up and made various commitments to improved nutrition, to improved investments in education, a variety of investments in aspects of nurturing care for children.
That's Gary Darmstadt of the Stanford University. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from California. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Shake up your bum bum, big girls them shake up your bum bum. You know what the, where you come from? Oh no 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 no, this girl she a calling my phone. Yeah. Oh no 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 no, this girl she no won't let me go. Every day she follow me for Twitter. Next thing she want me guy finger. She want me to answer. Every night she want me guy ringer. Baby shake up your bum bum, your bum bum. Ladies shake up your bum bum, bum bum. Bam bam, yeah. The way she dey whine, girl, you really mess up my mind. The way you roll your behind, if you make a man to go blind, girl, me love you to pito. The way she my music is sweet, the way she dance it, everybody dem a love it, yeah. She got your bam bam, everybody rap a bam bam, yeah. She got your bam bam, bam bam, bam bam. Shake up your bam bam, your bam bam, your bam bam. See, oh no no no, yeah 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 yeah. My body nah yeah yeah, but my mind go there. Yeah. Me I like it in lala, it in lala. Anyhow, give it to you. So, I know what you want. I'm still on the bam bam. All you got to shake up your bam bam.
Right now, me and my people, we are balling, yeah. We are got to the club every day and night. We popping. Everybody club pin. People them a jumping. Oh na na. Yeah, yeah. Now because I'm making money, the people say I join Illuminati. Yeah, but I really don't know. Now because I'm making money, the people say I join Illuminati. Yeah, well I don't know what to say. I'm not here to oppress. Sometimes I ask myself, I wonder how I got this far. I'm missing, boy, nobody used to care after us. Sometimes I ask myself, I wonder how I got this far. I'm the same person, nobody care about. Yeah. Right now I'm making money. Them say me a join Illuminati. Yeah. I don't know. Hey. Right now I'm making money. Them say me a join Illuminati. Yeah. I really don't know how my people get down. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Yeah, get down on it. How my people get down. Na, na, na. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Yeah, get down on get it. Down, oh, yeah. Get down on it. Me a join Illuminati, yeah. I don't know. Hey. Right now I'm making money. Them say me a join Illuminati, yeah. I really don't know. All my people get down. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Yeah. Get down on it. All my people get down. Na, na, na. Get down on it. Everybody get down. Yeah. Get down. All my people get down.
Bye. Jealous.
Oh, man, they watch you.
X and I, you know. I'm man with some shit. You gonna know. Are you ready now? Let your children.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Special greetings to the mayor of Kokombe, Ishmael Afo. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Mark Ferguson, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the drum sounds when the hawk appears with a rabbit. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 16th is World Food Day, a day of action against hunger. The day commemorates the founding in 1945 of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. On this day, people around the world come together to declare their commitment to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a great reduction of people living with hunger on a nearly daily basis. Back then, about 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Now it's about 1 in every 9. Nonetheless, that still leaves some 795,000 chronically hungry people around the world. Of these, 60% are women. And this despite the fact that most small farmers living in the developing world are women. And when women go hungry, so all too often do children. About 161 million kids under the age of 5 are malnourished. This means that their brains won't develop normally, they may have difficulties learning, and their physical and cognitive growth is stunted. Lack of nutrition compromises not only their own successes in the future, but also the development of the communities, economies, and countries in which they live. In addition to those children who are chronically undernourished, almost 5 million children under the age of 5 die of malnutrition-related causes every year. The global community is working to eradicate hunger because it is the right thing to do. The first of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for halving the production of people suffering from hunger and facing extreme poverty. We have achieved that goal. As we transition to a sustainable development agenda for 2030, we have raised our ambitions and are striving to effectively end hunger and extreme poverty altogether. The United States aids this effort through its innovative Feed the Future initiative. We partner with country governments, many universities, multilateral and non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations like the UN, research communities, and the private sector to lift millions of vulnerable people out of hunger and poverty. On World Food Day, the United States reaffirms its commitment to the fight against poverty, hunger, and undernutrition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.